The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the simplest, most powerful website creator that helps you make headlines with your own stunning online presence. Explore elegant templates, Getty image integration, and more at squarespace.com, and use the code Guardian to get 10% off.
The jungle was thick. The leaves of the tall trees were broad and green. I have tried to remember which trees they were, but I can only bring back the ones that gave me things to eat. Smoke rose from the place our village was, not the smoke of cooking fires, but a kind I had never seen before. It made the blue sky black and stilled the birds. There was not a sound.
I witnessed a more traumatic death when I was younger. Ever since then, I had been really afraid of death. And as I got older, that interest morphed into more of an academic interest.
I think the problem is that people don't read books before they decide to burn them. A lot of this book is actually very sympathetic to religion, and that it's trying to find out what draws people to it.
What I wanted to give them was the truth of what's happening during a cremation, during an embalming, during a funeral service.
A girl always remembers the first corpse she shaves. It's the only event in her life more awkward than her first kiss or the loss of her virginity. As taboo-busting openings go, Caitlin Doughty's must be up there with the best of them. Given that she's a mortician, even her title, Smoke Gets in Your Eyes, could make your stomach churn and, yes, your eyes water if you think about it too deeply. In this week's podcast, we'll be looking at how two books confront different sorts of cultural taboos. While Doughty stares down death, the Indian novelist Anuradha Roy casts a critical eye at sex, and in particular its place in Hindu religion and culture. But first, let's hear more tales from the mortuary, and hear from their 30-year-old author why she felt compelled to spill the secrets of the death industry.
There are many words a woman in love longs to hear. I'll love you forever, darling, and will it be a diamond this year are two fine examples. But young lovers take note. Above all else, the phrase every girl truly wants to hear is, "Hi, this is Amy from Science Support. I'm dropping off some heads." West Wind had an ongoing cremation contract with two anatomical donation facilities, of which Science Support was one. Several dozen lucky Californians who donated their bodies to be poked and prodded for the good of scientific inquiry ended their journey in my fiery care. After the phone call from Amy, a truck crept through the gate at West Wind and pulled up near the rear entrance where Chris unloaded his daily round of bodies. The back door creaked open. Two young men poked their heads in and looked around suspiciously.
Afternoon, ma'am. We're Science Support here with your, heads.
No matter how many times the transport truck came to visit West Wind, the Science Support drivers always looked supremely uncomfortable. They couldn't drop their cargo and get out of the crematorium fast enough. It made me proud to know the drivers of Ye Old Traveling Body Parts truck were intimidated by my workplace. Science Support is essentially a body broker, accepting whole dead bodies for donation and then dividing them up and selling the parts, as a junkyard does for old cars. Science Support isn't the only name in the body broker game. Several large companies trade in this macabre but quite legal field. While attending a conference in London, I brought up private, for-profit body donation during a panel. The UK professionals and medical ethicists looked at me like I'd suggested the brutal murder of a kitten. In the UK, your only shot for whole body donation is to a medical school. There are many positives to donating your body to science. In the modern death landscape, body donation is the only surefire way to make sure your death is free. After your death, Science Support will pick up your corpse, transport you to their facility, use you to cure cancer, note, results may vary, and then pay for your cremation at West Wind. Indeed, your body might be used on the front lines of medical research.
My own grandfather died after a long, debilitating bout with Alzheimer's, including one memorable Christmas Eve when he managed to steal the car keys in the middle of the night and disappear for 7 hours into downtown Honolulu. Ho, ho, horrible Christmas morning to you too, family. If the donated heads of Alzheimer's patients, with brains containing the plaques and tangles that turned my grandfather into a stranger, could make a difference to other families, off with their heads, I'd say. Unfortunately, not every dead body goes to what might be considered noble ends. There is a slim possibility that your donated head will be the head that holds the key to the mysteries of the 21st century's great disease epidemics. But it is equally possible your body will end up being used to train a new crop of Beverly Hills plastic surgeons in the art of the facelift, or dumped out of a plane to test parachute technology. Your body is donated to science in a very general way. Where your parts go is not up to you.
Caitlin, that was typically full of gallows humour, which very much dominates this book. And smoke gets in your eyes, even the title, it's a jokey title. And yet there's a very serious mission behind your writing, isn't there?
There is, yeah. And Smoke Gets in Your Eyes as a jokey title, it's actually, the idea was the joke of the smoke literally getting in your eyes, working at a crematorium, but also the pathos and things clouding your judgment and things clouding your experience. And there absolutely is a more serious message to what I do. It's trying to get people to face their own death and to realize that they're much more empowered than they think they are around death and around death care and around taking care of the dead body.
How on earth did you get into being a mortician, you call it in the States,
yeah,
don't you? Not
yeah,
an undertaker.
Exactly. And it's actually interesting. In the UK, mortician means a pathologist or someone who actually performs the autopsies, where in the US, mortician is more akin to an undertaker or a funeral director. I got into it. I didn't come from a family of undertakers. My parents weren't in the business. I came to it from academia, really. I witnessed a more traumatic death when I was younger, about 8 years old. And ever since then, I had been really afraid of death. And as I got older, that interest morphed into more of an academic interest. And I studied medieval history and the witch trials and death rituals in Europe in the Middle Ages. And I wanted to put that into more practical use. And being a medieval historian, there's not a lot of practical places you can go with that. But working in a crematorium when someone finally hired me really did put together all of the skills that I had and set me on the path that I'm still on 7-8 years later.
So you ended up at the Westwind Cremation and Burial Center.
Yeah, it's in Oakland, and I really didn't know what to expect when I came in. I knew about cremation, I knew about embalming, but it didn't prepare me at all for what the experience was actually like.
How much do any of us know about cremation? I mean, there's some really quite grisly detail in this book, isn't there?
There is. At the very beginning, I said I wasn't going to pull any punches because people really do want this information. And if they want mediated information or euphemisms and that kind of information, they can ask a funeral director for that and they'll get euphemism. But what I wanted to give them was completely unfiltered, grisly details, the truth of what's happening during a cremation, during an embalming, during a funeral service. And if I wanted them to be able to trust me and know that they were getting the truth from me.
You're very down on embalming, aren't you?
I don't know that I'm down on embalming. I think that you should be able to have the choice to have it done. Absolutely. Everything should be open to everyone. But at the same time, I don't believe that most people know what embalming really entails and what it is. It's quite an invasive process, and it's chemically preserving the body and replacing the blood with chemicals, preservative chemicals. And it also is indicative for me of people's fear of death and people's fear of decomposition and fear that the body might be something that naturally decays and decomposes and goes back into organic material.
This book spent some time on the New York Times bestsellers list. You're now bringing it to the UK. We heard a reading just at the beginning where you made a bit of a comparison between the UK and the American industry. How much have you had to change the details because of the differences? And what difference is there in the cultures?
That's a really interesting question and something that I'm still learning about all the time. And it's a really fascinating thing because there's so much conversation between the two cultures and so much influence both directions that it's almost hard to separate it sometimes. And what I did for the UK edition of this book is just really went through, and I didn't delete things that were about America. I just tried to add things about the UK. So when there was an interesting point of difference that I knew was there, for example, in the reading, I talk about how you can't have private brokers for donation in the UK. And then I also talk about, for example, that in the cremation, it's very rare in America for someone to come in and what's called witness the cremation, be there. Where in the UK, it's fairly common. You don't see the body beforehand. It's in the coffin or the casket, but you do see the body go down the conveyor belt behind the window and for the cremation. So I just tried to bring those up and make it clear that this was my experience because it is memoir, but that there is really fascinating differences between the UK and the US.
How much has it changed you? You're still a young woman. You've seen more death in your few years than most people will ever see.
Yeah, I don't feel like a young woman. I guess it's changed me in a lot of positive ways. I feel like a more self-aware person. I feel like someone who has more of an engagement with the world, more of an engagement with myself as an animal, as a human, but one that comes from the animal world and comes from nature, which I don't know that I necessarily did before. And I just have a sense of death being the driving force and the motivator behind most of what we do as humans.
And you say a culture that denies death is a barrier to accepting a good death.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's no way. I think we're such, humans are such visual creatures, and we want evidence for things in so many ways that if you never see a dead body and you never talk about a dead body and you never go to a funeral, how can you really have a sense of death being real?
You also see during your, it's not all about the death, is it? It's not about the dead body. You also can read back into the corpses the suffering that's happened before death. And you have sort of bits about, one of the things you say, that you find patients who come in with great big ulcers much more distressing than even babies or suicides.
Yeah. When you see, and this is a problem all over the world right now, where we're extending our lives and medical science is allowing us to extend our lives, which is good in certain ways. We certainly don't want to go back to a horrible mortality rate or very young mortality rate. But at the same time, we don't really have the resources to take care of all of our growing elderly population. And we have to be really careful about how we're extending lives of the people who aren't going to have a quality of life.
So is that part of your mission with this book? It's about negotiating end of life for an aging population.
It is. That's part of it. I feel like my wheelhouse is really the dead body. And that's what I care most about. That's what I understand most and I advocate for. But it's the end of life experience and the concept of the good death. It all comes together in that way. And if you're more comfortable with death and dying in the dead body, you're naturally going to be more comfortable having those hard conversations around end of life, which people are talking now, everybody's talking about end of life. And how can we have it? Well, being more comfortable with death and being more willing to have those conversations is one way we can change that.
One thing that came out of this very strongly for me is what an extraordinarily efficient industry it is. And you say two humans die every second. That's longer than it's taken you to read these words. Mm-hmm. There are all sorts of industries. We have all sorts of problems. The trains never run on time, all sorts of things. But you never hear of dead bodies piling up in the streets, even though they're dying at the rate of one every 2 seconds.
Yeah, you're right.
Every 1 second.
Yeah, you're right. Oh my God, there's so many. They're dying right now. That's a really good point. That's absolutely true. And they're very efficient, really, though, in the Western world, in the first world. It's not the same experience in India, in Africa. In America and in the UK, when somebody dies, we take them away really quick. We come in unmarked white vans. We put them under the cargo holds of airplanes. We have special stretchers in hospitals that have holes in them to put the body in and then put a flat top over it so you can't tell that the stretcher just looks empty, but there's actually a dead body in there. And so we're really, really efficient at covering up the corpse itself and the dead body itself. And we have a lot of systems in place for that. And you're right, it's almost like more important than the train running on time is to get any visual of death out of our sight.
I get the feeling that you don't quite approve of it because it's sanitizing everything. But on the other hand, it's absolutely essential, isn't it, in an urban society that you get your dead out of the streets, if only because disease will spread otherwise.
Sure. Well, the dead body is really not dangerous. I mean, unless it had some wildly infectious disease, if it had Ebola or avian bird flu, that's not a good idea to have in the streets. But the natural dead body of cancer or a stroke or of a heart attack, the disease or the bacteria that's involved in decomposition is not the same bacteria that causes disease. So dead bodies are really incredibly safe for us to be around. And I'm certainly not suggesting that dead bodies be piled up in the streets. We're not ready for that, and that's not necessary at all. But in an urban environment, it's still possible if somebody died under hospice care or somebody died at home, or even if they died in the hospital, to bring them home and have in the living room of your flat in London, have people over and have the dead body there and have some kind of ritual that's really meaningful and spend some time with the body and watch the little changes that happen and accept the death. And that's something that's completely legal to do and that you don't need a funeral home for.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about your colleagues in this business. We talked about gallows humor. I mean, you must have to have ways of dealing with sort of quite a lot of horror.
Absolutely. And it makes me a little uncomfortable when people don't use humor around death, almost, because that kind of solemnity doesn't work in the long term, I think. It means you're not quite dealing with it, because death is comic and tragic and grotesque and beautiful at the same time. It's really everything. It's the entire range of the human experience in one thing. So if you're ignoring part of it and acting like things don't happen that are funny or strange or ironic or bizarre, you're really, really repressing a part of the experience.
Have your colleagues read this book?
They have. The ones in the book, actually, that I worked with.
Mike,
Chris, and Bruce, those are their real names. And they read the book and they let me use their real names.
And so they're quite happy being represented like this.
I think so. I think that they're all kind of gruff gentlemen. So Chris said, you know, oh, I don't want to be described as having basset hound eyes. I don't look like Leslie Nielsen. I look like Brad Pitt. You know, he could have used some more flattering movie star descriptions in his opinion. But of course, my other colleague there, who's not in the book, but came to work at the crematory later, she sent me a message and she said, that's the best description of Chris I've ever read. So I contend that I got it right, but they've been very supportive and they're okay with it.
Where do you go from here? You've written the ultimate crematorium book.
I know.
Is your future as a writer, or is it devising new ways of dealing with death?
I don't know what my future. My future certainly is as an advocate. I'm actually opening a funeral home in Los Angeles, July 1st, knock on wood, everything permits going through, that will be much more family focused. And definitely there will be more writing because this book did well. And if you're an advocate, if something you try does really well and reaches people, that's where you go again. Me and other people who do this work really are trying to shift how we look at death. And it seems like it's starting to work. Yes, it's still a small movement, but there has been changes. And even if one person has a different experience of death that's more beautiful and meaningful, it's worth it.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
This is the biggest story in the world.
We will look back on these times and we will think, what on earth were we doing?
From The Guardian.
This is a story about people, and this is a story about possibility.
It's a story that's eluded us for decades. A topic which The Guardian is now throwing itself wholeheartedly into.
I'd seen how we'd done it on other things.
Climate change. So we're letting you in behind the scenes. Editorial meetings, bids for commissions. You'll hear what works, as well as our mistakes. And along the way, you can judge how we do. Is there a new way to make the world care? The biggest story in the world on The Guardian.
Caitlin Doughty there. And Smoke Gets in Your Eyes is published by Canongate. Caitlin says her experience in the mortuary business has left her convinced that there is no afterlife and no God, nothing after death except the decaying body and the need for the living to let go.
One can only imagine the conversations she might have with the characters in Anuradha Roy's novel Sleeping on Jupiter, who we meet over 5 days on pilgrimage in an Indian temple town. Roy confronts a different sort of taboo in this third novel, the connection between the sexual violence in Indian society today with the joyous and no-holds-barred sexuality of the Hindu pantheon.
The year the war came closer, I was 6 or 7, and it did not matter to me. I lived with my brother, father and mother, and our hut had 2 rooms with mats on the floor and a line of wooden pegs from which our clothes hung. And in the evening, we sat in the yard outside, watching our mother cook on the fire by the grapefruit tree. When the tree flowered, I opened my mouth wide to swallow the scent. Little green beads of fruit appeared when the flowers fell off. One day, when some of the fruit had turned as round and yellow as full moons, my brother climbed the tree. He looked tall and strong, clambering from branch to branch, my older brother. I stood holding the trunk, waiting for the fruit to come down. He snapped them off the stem. The branch shook hard, and I was showered with dust and dry leaves. The grapefruits were pale yellow outside, with stippled skin. They were as big as melons and heavy with juice. My mother slid a knife into one and cut it in half, and the flesh was pink, and the smell of its juice was tart and fresh. Our hut was all we knew, the four of us. I remember a fence around it, made of branches my father cut and brought home on his shoulders, a few at a time, every day. The jungle was thick. The leaves of the tall trees were broad and green. I have tried to remember which trees they were, but I can only bring back the ones that gave me things to eat. Mangoes, grapefruit, jackfruit, and lime. We had hens that went mad cackling and crowing when they were laying eggs. Their eggs were brown. We had a cow, a few goats, and 3 pigs. When the pigs were slaughtered for their meat, they shrieked with a sound that made my teeth fall off. And this was the sound I heard soon after my mother cut the grapefruit and the men came in with axes. Their faces were wrapped in cloth. They shoved my brother outside. They pushed my mother and me to a corner of the room, and then they flung my father at a wall. They slammed his face at the wall again and again. The whitewashed wall streamed red. They threw him to the floor and they kicked him with their booted feet. Each time the boots hit him, it was as if a limp bundle of clothes was being tossed this way and that. One of the men lifted an axe and brought it down on my father's forehead. When they left, they wrote something on the wall in his blood. They did not look at us. In my sleep, I hear the sound of pigs at slaughter, the sound my father made. The next thing was a clump of bushes by a ditch. My mother was hiding me in the bushes. Smoke rose from the place our village was. Not the smoke of cooking fires, but a kind I had never seen before. It made the blue sky black and stilled the birds. There was not a sound. I started to shout for my brother, but my mother put her palm over my mouth. If only she hadn't stopped me. He always came when I called, and he always knew what to do. I was walking after that as fast as I could. But still my mother kept pulling at my hand and dragging me, saying, "Faster, faster." Then she picked me up and I was on her back and my arms were wrapped around her. She ran through the jungle. My legs straddled her waist, my head reached her shoulders, but I could not look beyond. Her hair pricked my eyes. It was sticky with sweat and dirt. Her feet were bare. She stopped to pluck thorns from them, and once she stopped to tear off a strip from her sari and wrap it around her foot when a stone gashed it. If I asked for my brother, she said, "Quiet, not a word." My mother's face was fierce. She had thick, straight eyebrows, and she wore a nose pin that sparkled like a star. Her palm felt rough and hard when it slapped my cheek and when it rubbed oil into me before a bath. Although I scrape and scrape at my mind, there is not much else I can bring back.
Gosh, that is some opening, isn't it? It takes your breath away.
Well, yeah.
So tell us about that. You know, you go in really quite shockingly. It's difficult stuff. You're announcing a novel that has difficult stuff in it.
The opening is the girl who is going to become a refugee speaking as a child. And I wanted very much to get a direct, unfussy, straightforward language and her memory unfiltered right at the start of the book, because she was going to be at the center of the book. So yes, it is a very violent passage to start with.
And there are little details in that, like that sort of characterize your writing, like the vividness of the memory of the fruit. Fruit, yes, is something that it stays with her,
yeah,
when lots of memories she can't bring back, yes, because they're too traumatic.
In her memories, it is these colors and scents that I tried to focus on. It was quite hard for me to imagine the world of a child who has been as traumatized as she was. And I, of course, you make a sort of leap of imagination and try to get into her head, and you read up lots about what, you know, people who go through such trauma go through. And we know from ourselves that we remember these odd little things from our childhood. It isn't that you remember, you know, something in a straightforward narrative. So that's what.
But also there are little details like the fact that she could see that something was being written on the wall, but she couldn't read, obviously. She's
a 7-year-old
girl. At that
time, she can't read. She can just see someone's writing something with her father's blood, and that stays in her head. And the implication really is that when she's grown up, she must have thought so many times, what did they write? But she has no access to it.
You don't ever specify what this war is and where she is. You're from India, but yes, it's not India, is it?
No, it's a war in a neighbouring country, because she comes across by boat, ultimately, to India. And she's too little to really know the difference between countries when it happens to her. And I left it unspecified because all war is disastrous and brutal for children, wherever it is. And I wanted it to remain unspecified.
But you know in your head where it is.
Yes, because I had to also plot out her age and when this... If I didn't have it clear in my own head, it would have been hard for me to sort of articulate the whole narrative for myself.
This is actually backstory. So you have, yes, begun with a really important bit of traumatic memory.
Yeah.
But actually the plot of the novel takes place over 5 days.
Yes.
And it's 5 days of a journey to a temple town.
Yes.
Sort of fascinatingly, you have three of your characters are three elderly religious tourists, women,
yes,
sort of rather dumpy, not terribly fit, yes, religious tourists.
I'm glad you mentioned them, because the whole novel actually began not with her. It started as a long short story with these three women who have never been out on a holiday before, because like many Indian women in normal Indian lives, they've never had the time or money to do things for themselves. And it's when they've reached this age that they've decided to have this one last, you know. It's a really feisty sort of thing for them to do at their age in India, to say, we are going to leave our families and the three of us are going on a holiday together. When I had written this story, there was this girl on the beach that they spot, and I could sort of see her from the back. But she was not a main character. But I found myself going on thinking about, who is this girl and why is she on that beach? And the old women have a reaction to the way she's dressed and how she is. And that's how I started thinking about this girl and what may have happened to her.
And there's a lot of comedy invested in them, really, isn't there?
Yes.
Their aches and pains, and one of them gets a tummy bug, and they,
yeah,
have their sandwiches and their complaints about...
Yeah, and
Bella.
Homeopathic medicines.
And homeopathic medicines.
Yeah.
And then their encounter with... the person who we discover gradually through the novel is this orphan.
Yes.
Did they first spot her on a train?
Yes.
And she just happens to be in their compartment.
These three old women, I also found them an interesting way to, because the novel is very much about religion and sexuality in India and how it works in the lives of these older women who have been restricted and constricted in different ways, not oppressive ways, but all their lives. So when they encounter this girl, it's a collision with a completely different universe. And they feel half shocked and half protective towards her. So I found this an interesting thing to do.
Because when they encounter her, she is actually Europeanized.
Yes.
She has gone to Europe and has come back. And she is a different sort of tourist. She's a documentary-making tourist,
yes,
isn't she?
Yes. She was taken away as a child. She had no choice in where she went. She was placed as an adoptive child in a European country, in Norway. And she has come back partly for herself to go back to where she thinks she was taken as a refugee. And partly the pretext is this documentary film.
Mm-hmm. So you've got these flashbacks and within a very tight plot framework. Mm. It's not only about war, is it? It's also about, and you mentioned it's about religion and the oppression of women, but it's also about child abuse. And it's about the way that religion sanctions child abuse, because there is a sort of horrific seam of child abuse within an ashram.
Yeah. I think religion is very dominant in this book, and it looks at the way belief affects those who truly believe. These women and the temple guide are actually devout in a quite pure and selfless way. And religion also impacts children sometimes when it's just used for criminal ends by some people. So she's had the worst of it, absolutely, as a child.
This book has some very controversial stuff in it, and I was very struck by a particular line in it, which is, in ancient India, no barrier between life and love. Erotic is creation itself, so it is celebrated in our temples. That this is a guide explaining. And he says, nothing wrong, please understand.
Yes.
But the connection between the religious and the erotic, it does cause problems in this book.
Yes, it is ironized by what we know to have happened in the book. But what the guide is saying is absolutely true to him, as well as in fact, because in ancient India, it is absolutely true that there were all these very beautiful erotic temples, sculptures, writing around sexuality. And either we have become more puritanical now and also more warped because situations like the ashram have taken place. And if they did happen in ancient India, we don't know about them. So it is a very loaded sort of sentence. Yeah.
You're a journalist as well as a novelist.
Yeah.
There is an extent to which this is a journalist's novel. I mean, I'm not saying it fails as a novel in terms of the craft of novel writing, but it picks up on very topical issues, the issue of the abuse of women particularly and the abuse of sexuality and child sex abuse.
I think if you live in India as a woman, you are reacting to this from the day you are out on the streets alone, and you're fighting it all the time in different ways. So this book just happens to have come out now when all this is topical internationally, but it started years ago and all this has been going on for years. So it obviously is something that bothers me deeply. And I wouldn't call it so much a journalistic response as just a response to something that I feel involved in all the time. As you know, I am a woman in India. How do we live? And it's not only about women, but all the marginalized, like the tea seller or the temple guide who falls in love with a boy. And I think the brutality towards the helpless, because inequalities are so extreme in India, and people almost don't react anymore to this brutality to children, to animals, to women, to the marginalized, to the very poor. It's as if it's become routine, and that disturbs me profoundly. So this book is a kind of response to that.
Often we see those sort of stories told in an urban setting, but this isn't an urban setting, really.
Yes.
It's a seaside town.
Yeah. People tend to idealize sort of seaside towns, rural areas. But even in my last book, The Folded Earth, which was set in a very idyllic hill station, this is in the heart of the story as well, the sort of cruelty to animals and to a man in that who is half sort of semi-literate and half insane, and the way the officials sort of bully him and brutalize him into submission. So that is,
it's your third novel?
Yes.
In how many years?
The first one came out in 2008, so it's 7 years.
So 7 years,
yeah.
I mean, you have had a lot of success with your novels, haven't you? But you're not particularly well known over here.
No. Well, the first novel's been translated worldwide into 16 or so languages.
That was An Atlas of Impossible Longing.
Yeah,
it's a great title.
Yes. And yes, the second one won the Economist crossword in India, but it wasn't very well known here at all, I think. And now
this one, which is being published here. the first two novels almost set up the expectation that they were going to be sort of romantic sagas of India.
Yeah.
But they're not. Well, this one certainly isn't.
The second one was not a saga, but it did follow a conventional linear narrative storyline. With this one, when the narrative started coming together as the interwoven strands of different characters' lives, it lent itself to this kind of jagged, spliced kind of structure where I wanted there to be, you know, black holes which you would never know, where you would never be able to enter, areas of mystery and darkness where the reader would not be able to go or follow them.
Which is quite a brave strategy for a novel, isn't it?
I don't know whether it's brave or stupid, but anyway.
Because it sets a challenge, doesn't it? I was thinking, in a way, the structure is filmic because you've got jump cuts and lots of flashbacks and things. Was that a deliberate thing? You don't make film, or you haven't been involved?
No.
Although your character is a filmmaker.
Yeah, that was partly reflected in the structure, these filmmaker characters. Yes, it goes from here to there, and there are lots of open-ended bits, which some readers hate, but they'll have to use their heads and make it up for themselves.
How has it been received in India?
It's come out 2 days ago.
So it's literally coming out simultaneously?
Yes.
Are you anticipating any trouble? Because this is really riding into the neurosis of the culture, isn't it, these issues?
Yeah, but I think what we've realized now, well, for the past many years, ever since the Satanic Verses, is that you don't actually have to say or do anything to get into trouble, and that the trouble comes not only from the Hindu right, it can come from a fatwa, it can come from the Trinamool Congress, it can come from the AIADMK. Anyone can cause trouble, and anyone who is liberal and standing up for the oppressed, let's say, in any way, painting, film, novels, you have to bargain for some amount. You know, there's a risk in it. I don't know what's going to happen.
But women seem to be coming in for quite a hard ride at the moment. Like Shobha Day, the novelist who we had on this podcast from Jaipur, has been having real problems recently, hasn't she? Is that because she's a woman, or is that because of
I haven't been following what exactly happened to her, but it's pretty regular that, like Taslima Nasreen, for example, and it hasn't got to do with women at all. It could be any film or any book to which any fringe element takes offense and decides to cause trouble. The problem is that there is no state defense of the arts. Nobody will come and help you, so you're on your own.
Do you worry about it at all? About
all the time.
That this novel is going to land you in trouble?
I think the problem is that people don't read books before they decide to burn them. I suppose burning them is just easier. So if they did, they would see that a lot of this book is actually very sympathetic to religion, and that it's trying to find out what draws people to it, what kind of turmoil does it cause in people. But if they only focus on what is scandalous or what appears to be offensive, then they will not like it. So
do you feel that there's an area which you would deal with in journalism that is different to the area that you would deal with in fiction, or do you think anything goes?
No, the fiction happens, I think, in a different place altogether, because it is often, in my case, started off with some kind of image or a passage of words which I get down very quickly and then build from there. It's not as though I decide, well, I am bothered about the situation of women in India and so I will write this book to represent that. I think that would be very dull.
Anuradha Roy there, offering much food for thought. Sleeping on Jupiter is published by Maclehose Press. And that's it for this week. Thanks to Anuradha and Caitlin Doty. You can find more literary discussion on iTunes, SoundCloud, or on the Guardian Books website. Just search for Guardian Books Podcast. From me, Claire Armistead, and our producer, Eva Krishak. See you next time. Smoke gets in your eyes.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.